You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Hunt of Ore podcast, powered by Sportsman's Empire, where we celebrate the hunting and fishing lifestyle through the utilization and consumption of our wild game. No egos.
Fork in hand, beer in the other.
No status.
A piece of red meat on a hot grill and turn it into a burnt offering.
Just catch it, cut it, cook it.
This is episode 146, Emperor's Table Series, Brian Hallbly, and Migration Waterfall Podcast. On this episode of Hunt of Ore, Nick is joined by newcomer to the Sportsman's Empire, Brian Hallbly, of the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. Nick is a novice waterfowler who does love a quality prepared duck or goose. Nick probes Brian about some details about getting in on birds, and for waterfowlers, their pursuit can be as addicting as whitetails. Brian shares a few of what he's doing in the offseason. To finish up the conversation, Nick gets into Brian's... Well, hey, folks, beautiful afternoon here in Michigan. We're in the midst of spring, full on. I think winter is gone, but we get the high winds. We still get those cold temps. We were sitting at like low 40s with 15-mile-an-hour winds at a soccer game. I tell you, that chills you down to the bone. I mean, that rivals like mid to late November when you don't bring out your layers and you're standing there on the sideline hoping for the whistle to get blown, for the game to be done. So that's what's going on in Michigan. Just a lot of cold blowing, but we're getting the sunshine. That's the good thing going on here. Friends are finding turkeys. I got two friends with turkeys down, one of which with a daughter. So hats off to the Smiths. John and Bailey, his daughter, have already scored in on big Michigan toms. No real sightings yet of morels. Maybe people are keeping them quiet. Maybe they're going to let them grow just a little bit. But morels have not been yet had. I think ramps are still a little bit behind, maybe here in Michigan. We haven't got quite a few enough warm days yet to get those popping. But yeah, that's what's going on right now in our neck of the woods. But we're going to shift a little bit. We're going to not only jaunt away from talking turkey, we'll get back to that with the timing we have left with turkey season. But we're going to shift over into waterfowl. And this, I tell you, waterfowl is probably one of the least covered proteins that I do offer on the podcast. So shame on me. But we have an expert with us. In fact, we've got some exciting news that I'm probably going to be dropping here. We are having a new podcast join the Sportsman's Empire. I'm sitting with Brian Hallbly, and he is the host of the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. Brian, thank you so much for taking an hour out of your evening and just chatting it up. Tell me a little bit, how did you get into the podcasting world? What led you to swing on here into the Empire?
Well, first off, thanks for having me on, Nick. I really appreciate it. You do a great job with your podcast and enjoy following along and trying all the recipes and hearing the stories from your guests, and just really appreciate being able to come on here and chat a little bit with you. Yeah, for sure. My name's Brian Hallbly. I been in Southwest Pennsylvania my whole life. Grew up here, went to school here, hunted and fished here, camped here. My dad started taking me camping and fishing since I can remember, 4 or 5 years old. Back then in Pennsylvania, you had to be 12 years old to hunt. So I had to wait a while to take my hunter safety course, and ended up getting that when I was 12. But yeah, as far as how I got into the podcast, kind of fast forward the last 6 years, I've been a co-host on the Habitat podcast. It's a deer. We kind of focus on deer habitat. We've grown that over the last 6 years. It's doing very well. I've been a big part of that over there with Jared Van Hees, and just looking for something a little bit different after getting that grown. And one of my biggest passions is waterfowl hunting. So talked to Dan Johnson. He was talking about having a need for a waterfowl podcast for a long time, and kind of one thing led to the other, and we're going to give it a go.
Well, excellent. Excellent. Waterfowl, I don't know, maybe it's just me looking on the outside. I grew up on a poultry farm. I've got almost a weird relationship with waterfowl, and especially right now. Birds seem to transmit diseases real fast, and knowing and hearing about this avian flu coming either, being transported by Canada geese or being transported by other waterfowl that are coming down. It's been one of those things, like, I've really had to be cautious in how I approach that, especially as of these several years. In fact, when I do go around the farm, I've got one pair of boots, and then I have another pair of boots that I keep them separate, and that's where I go other places. So if I hit public land, if I go someplace to a different property, I wear those boots. But if I'm on site here around the farm and we need to be wearing boots, I have a separate set for that, just to try to keep those at bay. We don't want any mixing. So it does, but what I do love about waterfowl is it's an easy source, and a lot of times bag limits are pretty generous, and the quality of meat that you get off these birds is just astounding if you take care of it. I'm sure there's a ton of people out there that'll tell you, oh, I don't eat divers, or I don't eat, ducks because they're too livery, but it just comes down to how you're preparing that species, whether it's in the field or whether it's back in the kitchen. So I'm excited to dive in a little bit. Pennsylvania, it doesn't strike me as a huge waterfowl state, being that that's where you're hailing from. But at the same time, maybe that's the play there, because Pennsylvania is bordered by two, like, awesome waterways, one being the Great Lakes, think touching Erie at that point, and then you're not too far, depending on, especially being central PA, you're not too far from the East Coast. Where do you find yourself going most of the time when it comes to chasing waterfowl?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Nick. There's not a major flyway that kind of goes through any part of the state. However, I'm on the Ohio border here in the western edge of the state. We're pretty fortunate. Starting at the very north tip of western Pennsylvania, we have Lake Erie, of course. And then as you move south from there, we have several major river systems. We have several swamps, some very large ones, and a lot of tributaries and backwaters that feed into the Allegheny River there. We do get kind of our own little slice of a flyway. The Canadian birds will come across Lake Erie and work their way down the river system and some of the swamp systems we have. So it's not easy. It's not like a lot of the stuff you'll see on TV, but we'll have some days that you think that you're in Arkansas or on the Mississippi River somewhere. That's what keeps us coming back.
Excellent. Is waterfowling as much a year-round obsession that the deer hunter has become? There's a lot of deer hunters out there that's their species. That's what they stick with. They can do that 365. can waterfowling be that same bug where guys are looking at the sky every chance they get? Guys are trying to find where food sources are, what flocks are doing, or is it really kind of a niche point where when things turn on, that's when you turn on at that point? Is it one of those things that it's really special because you can really focus on to it for a short period of time, or is it something you think about 365?
Oh yeah, it's definitely 365 for me and most guys that are serious about it. There's a lot of similarities between waterfowl hunting and deer hunting. I'm a big deer hunter. I obsess over it. I've got leases and different properties that I'm working on habitat all summer, and it's kind of the same thing. I mean, there's always something going on in the off season. Just a few things off the top of my head. You can work on your calling, which is always a good thing to do. Blow your duck calls, blow your goose calls. Scouting so much, you can go and check out some new areas, but a lot of your listeners may or may not know, when it comes to migrations of ducks and geese, it really doesn't do you much good to scout off season as much as deer hunting does, because deer kind of stay in the same general area. But you could get out there for sure and check out some new swamps or river systems or lake systems that you'd never been before, just to say, hey, you know, this would be something to check out in the fall when the duck starts to push through. So, but yeah, I mean, from working on your boat or your kayak or your blinds, I mean, it's a year round venture. You got to keep your decoys up. Sometimes they need repainted, replaced. It'll keep you busy all year for sure.
I've got a buddy who, when you mentioned the repainting and the fluffing up of decoys, like, he has taken that to like the nth degree. Like, as much as he didn't get, or he doesn't have like an art degree at all, he doesn't have any sort of interest into any paintings that are in like the Louvre or that somebody has done. But I've never seen a guy obsess more over purples than this guy, trying to figure out which purple or which mix to put on the tails of some of his decoys for mallards. Is when it comes to dressing up and fluffing up your decoys, what kind of practice are you putting into them? Are you just taking care of them, like, you know, give them a good brush off at the end of season, put them away clean, and then come back and just refresh them? Or are you one that can really obsess over color? And I forget there's a coating you put on these things that really, like, has a texture to it. I guess it's eluding me. I don't know what the product's called, but something to really bring up the plumage and make it look like it's like standing up off the decoy.
Yeah. So I'm not obsessive to that level. I use a lot of, just normal store-bought plastic decoys. I store them, and I'm pretty anal about keeping them in their decoy bags. They each have their own slots, so they're not banging together and chipping paint off. But yeah, at the end of the season, I'll make sure that all the mud or anything else that's accumulated on any of them, get them washed off, keep them clean. Occasionally, I'll have to touch up a few here and there, but I'm more anal on the side of throughout the season, making sure everything's stored properly and taken care of all throughout the hunting season.
Waterfowling, I think people also forget the logistics. You're mentioning the way that they're stored, the way that you put things out. It's, for some spreads, it can be an absolute marathon of guys taking trips with bags, trying to get the spread to look just the way that you want it. Sometimes it's, you know, bag after bag after bag. And other times it's like, you know what, maybe smaller is better, depending on what the critters are doing, what's flying over at that period of time. So you want to have things at the ready, at the go. What are you, how's your transport system? You got, you know, do you have a enclosed trailer that you have these things like almost color coded or just laid out inside? So when you pull up, it's like you just grab and go. But then when you're all done, you know, guys, we can't get lazy. We got to get things back the way they need to.
Yeah. So I have a cap on my truck, so I can get quite a few decoy bags and any other gear that we normally use. I hunt a lot more ducks than geese. I've got some really hardcore goose hunting buddies that have enclosed trailers filled with full body mounts, socks, flags, layout blinds, you name it. They've got everything under the sun. And like you said, the logistics, you know, I was just talking to a buddy about getting up for turkey hunting, and he's like, I hate to get up that early to go for turkey. And I said, well, don't ever ask to go waterfowl hunting, because we get up about 3 hours earlier than turkey hunting time. So yeah, but, it can get pretty extensive for some of those hardcore guys chasing snow geese, or, some of those big field setups where they just have literally thousands of decoys or socks or things like that.
So running and gunning out of the truck, what is a typical setup that you're going to put together? So we're talking probably, you know, 6 bags total. Each bag's got, you know, a dozen. If you're maxing out the back of your truck, what's your layout blind looking like? Or essentially, I guess what I should say, what is the environment that you're looking for? Are you looking for a wide open field, or are you looking for something that's a little bit more of a pocket that you're luring these ducks into? Like, you know, they're feeding in this area and now you're trying to condense them down. What's your approach to bring the ducks to you?
Yeah, it's all scouting dependent. I mean, the birds will show you where they want to be. You got to put a lot of windshield time in. If you have a boat or a kayak, you got to get back in, see where the ducks are feeding or the geese are feeding, whether it's a swamp, a field, a river system. Normally, my type of setup for duck hunting, if I had to choose, you know, an exact setup, it's usually about 3 dozen decoys. I try to run a spinner or two, and we've got some pulsators that add some motion to the water. Looks like a feeding duck. The butts come up and it kind of wobbles in the water and makes it look like motion. That's the key. If you don't have wind moving your decoys, you need some type of jerk cord or pulsators or some type of spinning decoy with the wing spinners.
That way it doesn't look like a bunch of plastic laying out there. you actually have to make it look alive.
Yeah. Yep. The duck sight and the goose, the vision that they have on them is just incredible. And they can pinpoint some stuff real easily, and they know what looks natural and what doesn't. And that can make all the difference in the world, especially as you get later in the season and these ducks have seen everything from Canada to by the time they get to me.
Yeah. They've seen the novices try to get out there. They pick them clean. And as they get further down to you, like, you really probably, the more further south you get, you got to be more crafty with how you're putting those together. So for yourself, you're looking at layout blind then, just really trying to match yourself in, or do you have a different approach that you're going? Are you being right in the spread? Or again, probably depending on the way the wind is going, you might want to be, you know, a little bit off to the side or something.
Yeah, so if we're in an open field situation, you're definitely going to need some type of layout blind where you can get close to the ground and get yourself covered up. And usually you'll stubble that blind in with either corn or wheat or whatever field you're laying in. You want to get that as brushed in as you can. As far as if we hit a swamp or a river or a lake, we have some portable blinds that we use. We've hunted out of some A-frames, basically like the shape of an A, and there's a little opening in the top where you can have some grass and other things brushed in. You can just pop up out of there. We also have a portable blind that folds up, and it has a complete mesh roof on it that you can push back away from you. That's the one we use most often. It's easy to take on a kayak or a boat. You can get in there and find a spot to get set up and just use the natural vegetation to kind of brush yourself in the best you can.
Excellent. Well, I feel like we've covered some basics here. Now, Brian, I really want to get a little bit deeper on this. What species has you all fired up? What is your duck of choice?
Yeah, it won't come as much of a surprise to most people that are into it. Mallards. just the way that they respond to calls, the way that you can work them, just the sight of seeing them cupped up coming in, especially when the sun's hitting that big green head of theirs. So that's probably one of my favorites. You know, and it could be hit or miss throughout the season. So wood ducks are always a great choice. One of the most beautiful ducks. A Drake wood duck's hard to beat, and they're very plentiful all around Southwest Pennsylvania. So, but I'd have to go mallard if I was forced to give an answer on that.
Gotcha. Just because the opportunity, and you know, you were just mentioning earlier, just the sight of them, they're just beautiful as they come in. With those, I guess I got, again, this is my novice point to them. You're coming out of the sky. You got to be very careful in identifying what's flying in, because there's not a whole lot of grace to the CO, to the conservation officer, as they're coming in. You got specific, if you're after specific things, you got to be after that one. Like, you don't have a hen limit, or you can't take hens, can you, in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so you're allowed a total of 4 mallards right now, at least this past season. Only 2 of them can be hens. So yeah, if the first 2 you shoot, and we try not to shoot hens if we can help it. And there's no scientific basis or anything to that. I don't know why me and my friends do that, because the biologists say you should shoot hens. That's why we allow you to take 2. And I don't look down on anybody for shooting hens. If that's what you want to do, if you want to shoot your limit and get your 2 mallard hens, more power to you. I mean, it's legal, and it's probably better for the resource to mix it up. But yeah, you gotta know your ducks. Mallards aren't too hard. They stand out pretty easy. The males have that deep gray, kind of like my shirt, the gray chest that shines in the light. And the green head, of course, is very easy to pick out. Where you can get in a lot of trouble, early season teal. They're very fast. They're hard to see. And you might have some wood ducks come in, and while you're shooting your teal during teal season, you got to be careful, you know, not to shoot like some woodies and stuff early on before the sun gets up.
Dry-aged steaks used to be a steakhouse-only indulgence. An old-world charcuterie was pricey due to being imported or created at a small batch-specific scale. Thanks to UmiDry, their synthetic dry-aging bags and cases allow you to create these meat-crafting treats in your own kitchen. Working in tandem with your fridge, the UmiDry bag material allows moisture and air to pass through, making it possible to dry-age large cuts of steaks or roasts. Paired with their curing and seasoning kits, along with safe and easy to follow instructions, salamis and dry sausage are well within your grasp. Use the link in the show notes and sign up for the newsletter to receive 10% off your order. UmiDry, helping us elevate our wild game from the home kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. When you start getting species that are mixing, like those small ones, in my few attempts, I've heard teals whistle over. I've never connected on one. They are just like fighter jets screaming over the top.
Crazy.
Yeah, they're quick. So you get a few limits. Bam, bam. You drop a couple right there in the water. When it comes to, and this is me being the meat guy, what's your process? In the field, are you just pulling them out, sitting them off to the side, dealing with them later? Or are you gutting them right on site? What are you doing with the ones that you end up bagging?
Yeah, later in the season, as long as the weather's favorable, if it's cool, you can get away with just piling them up until you finish your hunt. Early on in the season, if you're shooting teal, if it's 80 degrees in September, you're going to want to have a way to cool those things down, have a little cooler, or have at least a shaded area you can put them in until you get back to the truck and get them cleaned out.
Yeah, I just reread an article by Hank Shaw, and his whole thing is on when it comes to waterfowl and upland birds, whether it be your grouse, whether it be your quail, and even into waterfowl, aging these birds with the gut in. He's got a whole rhyme and reason and a whole article. If you haven't checked that out, that is definitely a good read. You can find that on the internet. But it's just a great read on aging the meat, but using the gut to, as you're aging these things for, you know, 2 or 3 days, it actually helps with the flavor. But at the same time, like you said, you're getting some of those ones early season, 80 degrees. I'm willing to, if I'm going to age it later, that's fine, but I'm going to pull that gut out. Like, I'm going to try to get the hot element out of them birds, get them, yeah, get them in the chiller, and then we'll age them once we get them either in some ice or, you know, to a fridge later. When you start to pluck your birds, have you had a chance to get them to sit for a couple days and then get after them? Or do you end up, as soon as you're done with the hunt, get right into the pluck?
Yeah, so I've done both. But just real quick to touch on what you talked about with the aging with the guts. I know there's an Asian application. A lot of times they'll hang the duck by the neck with a rope and they'll leave it hanging outside. And it's not ready until the neck separates and the body of the duck falls on the ground. Then they know it's ready to prepare. So I've never gone quite that far, but it's it's very interesting. And I've had some amazing duck prepared by a lot of skilled Asian cooks that are just out of this world. So I guess don't knock it until you try it.
Yeah, it's one of those points, I think, like, yeah, no, don't knock it until you try it. But you look at it yourself and you're like, am I confident enough to let this just sit here until right. that vertebrae finally separates? I mean, that's really on a knife's edge. You know, that really takes talent. Whereas I feel like sometimes my setup, I did upgrade to a chiller. I actually have like a real nice chiller now. But before, when it was me and the deer and beer refrigerator, as I called it, like I'm going to need a little more equipment than that to do sure. the aging. But you've had a chance to play with both of them. How do you find the pluck giving it a day or two? Do you find it a little bit easier on the pluck as you being able to get that plumage off? Or do you find, it's kind of give or take whether you do it right out of the sky or out of the fridge?
Yeah, I mean, most ducks aren't very difficult to pluck to begin with. So I've had hunts where I've gotten home and something has happened and it's like, oh my gosh, I was running late. I'm not going to get to these ducks for a couple of days. They do seem a little bit easier the longer you wait, but it's not difficult. After a hunt, they usually come off pretty easy.
Yep. Wing feathers. How far are you getting out on your wing? Are you sticking with just the two main, you doing the drummy and the mid wing and then just
that's
forgetting
all.
The tip or
that, yeah. That's all I'm doing. I've got some friends that'll go out as far as leaving the feet on and roasting it with the feet on too, but I don't get it into that kind of detail.
Yeah. There's some culinary goodness to be had there, but at the same time, like it's one of those, again, you're reaching really out there. Sure. I love the idea of leaving the feet on. What a way of presentation, you know, when it comes
absolutely.
Out and you get the little paddles.
Looks beautiful, yeah.
Paddles sticking out there. So yeah, we've talked about plucking. What are you going for when you're keeping out of the gut? Are you a gizzard guy? Are you gonna go in and clean out those gizzards, or is it like, I'm gonna stick with what I know being the flesh of the animal?
Yeah. So most of that stuff my dog ends up eating. So I'm not a big gizzard, not a big
dog
guy. I've tried it. It's just, I've never gotten a taste for it. So, you know, probably could do some more experimenting in those areas to try to tailor it to my taste.
Gotcha. Yeah. I asked just because like, it's one of those things, like I'm always trying to find something else. What else can mm-hmm. I glean off of something. I've been gifted a bunch of wood ducks, and they're a delicious little duck, but it's really like a half a duck will feed my wife and then it will like appease me for a minute. I'll need to add something else to another half of that.
Right.
But if I've gotten two or three, like I've been able to feed those to the boys and they enjoy the surprise of the duck. They really like how the meat is much darker. It's much richer. With those woodies, the fat potential, I think as early as they were taken, there was just not a lot of fat potential. Right. Real fine skin, almost pheasant-like, where if I wasn't careful on the pluck, I could take a BB hole and just rip that right on off. Mallards sound like they can stand up maybe a touch better on that. They've got a little bit more beef to them. How many people are you feeding off of one duck? Is that you get one duck in the oven? We've plucked it. Let's say we do a whole roast. Is that like a one family type deal when it comes to cooking up one of those ducks?
Yeah, I'd say 4 or 5 people probably max, depending on how hungry everybody is. You might stretch it out 6 maybe, but yeah, one family for sure.
As you're eating this duck, maybe it's a Michigan waterfowl thing, not to throw my own countrymen, my own statehood under the bus, but I do know there's a bunch of guys that they breast out their birds and they call it good. Like they don't put a ton of time into keeping the rest. I go in trying to urge them to pluck their birds and they're doing better. At least the guys that I've had a chance to be with. I've also been gifted a bag of just legs and thighs, which they're like, Otto eats them, so give them to Otto. So they'll actually pluck the bird and then just lop the dark meat off and then send it off to me. Maybe it's just me, but I think there's a wealth of meat and flavor and goodness out of what usually gets left out in the field. And I feel like that's the leg and thighs. The richest that you can get off there. Again, the thicker hide is going to be right there on those thighs. You're going to get a little bit more fat development. It won't like definitely bubble up like it will on the breast. But man, when you simmer legs and thighs off ducks, whether it be wild, whether it be domestic, I tell you what, that stuff is like velvet. It just shreds up beautifully. I can't understand why it gets left out there, Brian. Is it just one of those, it's just a hard piece for guys to wrap their minds around? Or, I don't know, is it just, you know, sometimes hard to get those out of the field?
Yeah, I think it's probably a couple of things, depending on who their mentors were. Maybe that's how they were taught and that's all they know. I run into guys like that all the time. They're like, oh, you can actually do this and get, you know, a little bit more of the fat and a little bit more of the skin. Like, yeah, you take your time and do this. So I think a lot of it is just knowledge. I think most guys are pretty responsible to try to get as much as they can out of everything that they're killing. They want to make use of it, but could be a time thing too. You know, it's a lot speedier just to knock the breasts out of there and keep moving. But yeah, hopefully there's enough people out there waterfowl hunting listening to this that'll say, you know what, I'm going to start taking my time. Maybe we'll start changing a few minds anyway.
Right. We're gifted a bag limit and being able to now, maybe it's one of those things like you're gifted a bag limit. You get the bag limit, like show, let's really celebrate the amount that we got and glean everything that we can. We were gifted this out of the sky. As much as we want to say we have so much control over things, you know, that bird flew into your set, you know, on its own accord. You can persuade it, but you didn't pull it in on a string. You did knock that bird out of the sky. You know, you've ended its life cycle. I think the thing we owe it to it for coming into your spread is to use every little bit of it to our own benefit.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I'm a full-on believer in Christ, but at the same time, I also feel like maybe there's a little bit here that, you know, if I do right by that bird, maybe more birds will come my way.
There you go. I can't disagree with that.
Well, Brian, we've done a lot of, you know, we've gone from the field, we've gone a little bit to our processing here, and now we're going to put our aprons on, and I'm going to kind of pick your brain here. You had just mentioned earlier in a conversation we had had, I asked like, hey, do you skin them? Do you breast them out or do you pluck? And you were adamant saying that you pluck and you like to keep your birds whole. Tell me a dish that's one of your go-tos that when you're introducing someone to duck, what, where are you going with it? Are you still going with the whole bird at this point? So we're kind of exploring the whole bird, or are you picking out a specific piece just to show off to someone? Where are you going when you're first introducing duck to either a friend or an acquaintance?
Yeah, so it depends on their taste, I think. A lot of people are open to trying a whole roasted duck, if that's the case. One of the recipes that's super hard to beat, I call it orange duck. I think the official name is like duck à l'orange or some French pronunciation, but it's a pretty easy dish to make. The orange pairs super well with the meat. And it's kind of strange because in that preparation, you're going to cook the duck a little bit further than you normally would. But the orange sauce that you make with it kind of pairs well with that type of preparation. So you got to be careful with most preparations. You don't want to cook your duck more than medium rare. But that one you cook a little bit further, and it holds up with the sauce a lot better. So pretty easy to make. You can find that orange duck recipe just about anywhere. I've got a couple go-tos that I've tried that have all turned out good, but that's a great way to prepare a whole duck for somebody that's never tried it before and you don't want to scare them off.
Yeah. Yeah. Poultry does just bangers with citrus. I know turkey and lemon and orange work out awesome with turkey. Anytime that I'm doing like the schnitzel or just the tenderloin, like taking half a lemon and just giving that a good squeeze right over the top, that just makes everything pop. So to add that, yeah, to really add that deep orange into, you know, a really rich animal being a duck, that sounds just wonderful. Easy way to be able to introduce someone to duck. As someone new to waterfowling, I know there's a nuance with getting a perfect crispy skin on that breast. I've heard a couple different variations, but whether it be you start with a hot skillet and it's all on a specific time. I've heard you start with a cold pan and then you turn up the heat so the fat renders out. Then you let it crispen up, then flip over to the other side. If you're just preparing a breast, are you hot and fast, or are you the cold pan, let it render out, and then flip it?
Yeah, I usually go cold pan to start, let that fat render out a little bit. That's my go-to way to do the breast for sure. That helps you not to...
Good.
That helps to not overcook it too, because I think people have the tendency, if they get the pan too hot and they're leaving it too long, you can overcook it pretty quickly, especially with the smaller wood duck breasts and teal breasts.
Yes. That I did the cold pan with the wood ducks, but the problem is I didn't have the amount of fat, so my poor potatoes. I mean, I did have some beef tallow, so I was able to get those at least some beef tallow potatoes. But from what I hear, duck potatoes are where it's at. Like that's a richness that everybody has to enjoy.
There's a lot of restaurants that are frying their French fries in duck fat nowadays. It's pretty special stuff. There's a lot you can do with duck fat, no doubt.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brian, I've gotten you for like a starter for that orange duck. So that one's kind of off the table. So this one might take a little bit of extra thinking. But being a new member here to the Sportsman's Empire, we're glad to have you on. And in my go around, as I talk to all Sportsman Empire podcasters, I want to know, what would you bring to a gathering of podcasters? And I call this usually Emperor's Table, where we're all together. We get a chance to meet face to face, not just digitally, but now we're going to sit at this large banquet table and everybody's got to bring a dish. And some guys are super fancy with it. I know Paul Campbell, he knocked his turkey out of the water. His is a citrus bird. He's brining it for a long time. It goes to the nines. And then I've also got podcasters who they're like, man, I don't know my way around the kitchen. All my wild game goes to my wife and she takes care of it. So we've actually had some wives be introduced that they were going to cook whatever dish for this made up potluck. But Brian, being as the waterfowl guy, you get introduced, throwing the curveball to you. You now got to serve a bunch of dudes at a potluck. You've already used your orange recipe. That's out. How are you going to prepare duck for this potluck?
So I do a lot of smoked meats. I've got a couple of different smokers. I've been smoking meats for over 20 years here. I love making cured and smoked meats. Duck pastrami, goose pastrami is probably my go-to. I've never had anybody have my pastrami with a little bit of horseradish sauce, with some sharp provolone cheese and some good crusty bread. I've never had anybody say this is inedible. They've gone bananas over it. So I'd have to go with my pastrami sandwich for sure.
Oh, heck yes. I'm in on the pastrami. Take me through your cure. How you go about, what's going into your brine?
Yeah, so I've got a couple of recipe books that I always fall back on. I've got Charcuterie. It's by Michael Ruhlman. Of course, I've got the Meat Eater cookbook. And I've got an old school one called Great Sausage Recipes and Meat Curing by Rytek Kutas. I can't remember which country he's from, somewhere over there in Eastern Europe. But they're all excellent resources. I follow the pastrami recipe out of Rytek's Great Sausage Recipes, a meat curing book. I highly recommend, you can still get it. It's still in print on Amazon. That's the one I'm always going to. Yeah, I'd have to dive in here because I don't remember the exact mixes off the top of my head, but it's a little bit of pink salt, a little bit of kosher salt, some sugar. And then you just rub that down, and you're basically making like a corned beef almost. You're corning it first, because that's all pastrami is. It's a smoked corn product. So once it's cured, then you put it in the smoker for a few hours.
Yes, yes. I've done my bottom rounds on my deer. So I've actually got a little stockpile now of bottom rounds. I find that bit of toothiness, with a shape, you know, slicing as thin as you can makes a dynamite sandwich for that pastrami. And yeah, doing the black pepper and coriander on the outside. Do you end up coating the whole thing again with that? Does Rytek have you do that? Oh,
absolutely.
And I'm sure just a little bit in the smoker with some of that waterfowl. Just enough toothiness. You don't want it to melt right away. You don't want it to fall apart. You want to be able to chew on it. Like, oh, that's going to be good. Better results with geese or with duck? Just the geese offering the bigger breast.
They're both good. I've never had a complaint about either one. They both respond very well to that process. Just watch your measurements. You got to be precise with how much salt and sugar, especially if you're using a type of pink salt or an Instacure type salt or something. Just make sure you're weighing your meat and using the right amount of cure.
Yep. 0.25 ounces per 1 pound of meat. I think that's the ratio.
That sounds digitally right.
Yeah. 0.25, which equates down to like an eighth of a teaspoon per pound. Like, again, this stuff is no joke. You, I'm sure long-term effects are not good with over-curing your stuff. But at the same time, once you just find that, once you can get your measurements down, just like you said, you open up a whole new world of being able to preserve meat, the color you get off that, the flavor enhancement you get off curing. Yeah, I'm okay with being a little bit of a chemist when it comes to getting that stuff down just right.
Absolutely.
And I assume when it comes to, you know, having 20 years into smoking meats, do you have a particular wood that you're like, yep, waterfowl needs this particular wood? Is it a fruit wood, or are you gonna, can you go hardy enough like a hickory on your waterfowl?
My screen was freezing up there a little bit. I missed that last part.
Oh, so sorry. When it comes to smoking the meat, are you sticking with fruit woods, or are you bold enough to, you know, jump over to hickory and have a little bit more substance off smoking your waterfowl?
Yeah, apple's my go-to. I really like the flavor that the apple imparts to it. It's not too harsh, and I've never really gone any further than that. I don't think a harsh smoke would be fitting for waterfowl. So, apple or cherry,
right?
Maybe you can get away with some maple. I've never messed with that. That's a little milder. But the apple, I just always use apple. I get good results from it and excellent flavor.
Gotcha. I stick hickory. Hickory for a lot of things, and it works out. I mean, venison, it pairs well, amazing with. I've had really good results with turkey. So, yeah, hickory seems to be my just go along the with everything. I think I still have a little bit. Well, I do have a couple mulberry trees that need to go down. I took a mulberry tree out of my backyard, and being it was a fruit wood, I used the mulberry on my charcoal grill, and that gave me a wonderful flavor. So maybe I might have, next time I get a hold of some woodies, I might have to add some mulberry. That might be a nice little change up in there. It's one of those things too that I can envision a duck, you know, getting back on the bank and nipping off a few of those ripe berries that fell on the ground. Like, I feel like there's just a little cycle thing going.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, Brian, this has just been a fun time to get a chance to get to know you, know your heart about waterfowling, and, yeah, get to know where your stomach is at when it comes to using and enjoying your wild game. Where can we find more about Brian? Where can we find more about the Migration Waterfowl Podcast? Because it's coming up here next month. Am I right? It's going to be here on the Nation? Or excuse me, yeah, here on so the Empire?
we're scheduled to launch May 2nd. I don't know when this episode is going to launch, but it's going to be pretty quick here. But yeah, we're all set up on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. Everything's the same. It's just Migration Waterfowl. Type that into the Google or Facebook or Instagram search. You can find us. Yeah, we're looking forward to getting rolling. We've already recorded 4 or 5 episodes, and we're going to hit the ground running here soon.
Perfect. I love it. So you keep saying we. It's Brian, and who's the team over there?
Yeah, so my friend Branson Peak, he's 25 years old. I'm 49 now, so we've got a nice balance of sort of his younger perspective and his experience coming up now that he's getting more into waterfowl hunting. And then you've got my age and experience, so we're hoping to bring kind of a unique perspective to a larger audience of waterfowl hunters.
Oh, I like you're taking advantage of that. You're getting, yeah, we're getting the experienced and the young gun in there. You didn't bring a dog. A duck goes in the middle of the pond. Who gets it? You or Branson?
Whoever's closer to the kayak, probably.
I mean, he's young. He's like the dog, man. I'd send him. I'd get the whistle. Yeah. Beep, that's you, bud. That's you.
He's pretty good about that for sure.
Well, excellent. Brian, this has been awesome. I'm going to have you hold on for just a second as I let our listeners on out. Folks, I hope you enjoyed this little hour here that we've had. Got a chance to just know a new member here at the Sportsman's Empire, talking with Brian and really getting excited about waterfowl. I know me personally, it's always been one of those like niche things off to the side. I've gotten a chance to enjoy waterfowl, but haven't gone and deep dove into any aspects of it. So to be able to glean some information here off Brian has just been super cool. If you yourself happen to be a waterfowler, oh, I can tell you the next podcast that needs to be on your list, and that is going to be the Migration Waterfowl Podcast, starting up here the first week of May. So folks, whether it's the big Canadas that are coming down that you're going to be taking late season, or if you're going to try to sharpshoot some of those teals as they scream over the top of you, make sure that when you're gutting them, your knife is very sharp.